You are listening to Let's Go, the weekly anime podcast about a weekly anime from Dynamite in the Brain and Secret of the Sailor Madness. So come along and hang with the Let's Go gang. It's Dwayne.
Hello.
It's Niall.
Goddamn.
And it's me, Brian. And on this episode, we are covering anime that aired the week of the 16th of September to the 22nd of September, 2019. Didn't say 2019 twice this week. And we're going to start off with Wacky TV Na Na Na, episode 24, Dismissed, the TV Na 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 Expedition Crew. We discover that, despite what I claimed, that there was no cave collapse last week, there was one.
Fucking change in history is what they're doing, just rewriting it as they go.
in which the TV channel has been saved from purchase by Nanazon, because Nanazon had spent their money fixing their headquarters, which had mysteriously sunken into the ground and had tipped like the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Mysteriously blocked from founding a new headquarters in the city because of the impact it would have on local communities. Also collapsing.
Yeah. You can't really acquire a new business if you have to fix up your old one.
Yeah. As they didn't find the treasure, they're like, what are we going to do with this footage? Well, edit what you've got into something useful and we'll stick it on after the film sort of the weekend.
Yeah, at the double bill slot or something like that?
Yes.
Lazy Sunday afternoon watching a wrestler battle a giant cyclops.
Honestly, that seems pretty rad.
I
think you could give that a more prime slot, but fair enough.
Yeah, I did like how they were so happy that, oh, we're saved, now we can continue to make TV programs for no money.
Yes, so you still have to make TV shows on your minuscule budget as opposed to just being fired.
it's not sure which is better.
The victory is very, very slight.
Yeah. You know.
We got our crappy jobs back. Yay.
Better than no crappy job, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose in this economy.
I did like the two shots of your man suplexing that giant cyclops, showing the cross section, and then like the way they'd edited it into the special for that weekend slot. Yeah, it's like, oh, he really pulled them a solid.
And I guess that's the last episode.
Looks like it.
Certainly felt that way.
Mm. Well, if they made a second season like this one, then hopefully it's bound to be a third, because it's spinning straw into gold here.
I feel like if they do a third, we have to go back and watch the first.
Though. Oh god! Oh, I've already watched bits of the first already.
Okay.
I pulled a fight scene for a panel from London first season.
Excellent.
Look forward to that, Kibana Khan Gores. Mm. I'll see you on November 7th to 9th. Probably know these things being a guest panelist at this convention, but I know when it's on.
It's the 8th or the 10th.
8th or the 10th. Well, I'd be there early then.
Hmm. Righty-ho. I do apologise, listening if you're hearing things going on outside my flat. Makes change for it to be me rather than Niall for a change.
Yes. There should be no criminal activities or domestic disturbances. Finally, the authorities be called in to disperse it this week. The foxes are making an awful racket, though, so hopefully it doesn't come across in the mic.
No, I can hear no foxes, but I can hear people moving around up and down the stairs, loading a van, I think. Okay, then we've got The Demon Girl Next Door, episode 11, Diving Into Dreams Once Again, Breakthrough the Pink Defense Line, in which... in order to get Momo on her side, Lilith suggests, well, why don't you just invade her dreams and make her, like, alter her dreams so that she adores you and then lets you in on all her secrets.
Yeah, because her plan was just to make her a lunch every day, and she'd be like, oh, wow, thanks for the lunch, a seventh day in a row. My weakness is my elbows is a trick elbow and goes out of place pretty often. And she's like, ouch. Yes. I was just really amused by that. It was just like, get in her good graces and she'll just tell you her weaknesses like good friends do.
But she's got a pretty strong psychic firewall, first in the shape of a very muscular cat, and then a door that she can't get in until Bobo invites her in because Bobo has started lucid dreaming. And then rather than get secrets out of Bobo, it ends up with Bobo getting secrets out of her, as a story does not add up about her father, who apparently went away squid hunting on board a space battleship.
No, you're mistaken. He went away squid hunting on a nuclear submarine, and then he eventually started working on a space battleship. You got to get his job path correct there. And yeah, but Momo's kind of like, that doesn't fucking add up at all.
What anime was this? It sounds like a lot of things.
And so...
No, it's real life.
As she's waking up, Momo's like, you grill your mother, grill your mother. And then when she wakes up, she's like, Momo wants to eat my mother.
That was... I don't know what the translation was, but they did some top-notch fixing it up there. Where it's like, oh, you gotta hold her over the fires to really grill her. And hold it's like...
Feet, put her feet to the flames.
Yeah. They did some really good fun things where you can read it two ways. Where they're both talking about it. It's like, yeah, we're both going to grill her.
Yes.
It's like, you would grill your own mother? It's like, well, if I thought I could get something out of it, sure.
Yes,
right there in the hot seat.
The pair of them start arguing outside the front door and going back and forth in this way until eventually the mum interrupts because she's like, I've been listening and it's so annoying hearing the pair of you misunderstand each other.
I'll tell you everything. There's no need to figuratively or literally grill me.
Secret of your birth.
Yeah, so this is where it gets complicated. So apparently the demons in this town are being protected by a spell cast by the previous magical girl who hides them from the other magical girls because the magical girls get points for killing demons, which allows them to
like,
raise
so they
up
lose
in ranks.
Magic by expending it, but they probably, through this point system, gain it by killing demons or demonic monsters or whatever. So yeah, the prior magical girl of this town,
yes, and because
basically put a ward on them to keep them safe.
Yeah, Yoko was ill, and so the magical girl readjusted their curse, so the curse wasn't affecting Yoko's health because Yoko got the most demon blood out of the pair of the children, and instead that became the 400 yen a month or whatever, 400 yen a week.
Yeah. So it's like your kid isn't going to be incredibly ill for her life, but you do have to live on 400 yen a week or a month, whichever it is. Not fucking much money.
But in return, the dad had to sacrifice himself, and he was sealed away inside the Mikan box, which they've been using as a table throughout the entire series.
I fucking love that. That was a good joke.
is that the ward they've cast over the demons? Is that like her running like a cartel to get all the points for herself?
Well, no, to protect them.
Yes,
basically.
It's entirely benevolent.
There was a sticker on her door that was, or a seal on her door that would protect if magical girls wouldn't be able to break into their apartment, kind of thing. So it was the idea that, no, this actually protects them. It masks them from magical girls.
Yeah, and this magical girl is Momo's sister-in-law, the one who's gone missing that she's searching for.
Yeah, she went missing 10 years ago, and the mother thinks it's like, yeah, she might have used up all her magic to change the ancient curse.
Yeah,
or
but
the curse that keeps them safe.
Yeah, would, now feels
to
guilt.
To change it to help their daughter.
The dad's sealed away.
So it's like, I guess we were truly enemies after
all.
Yes,
the best bit of this part is when, as soon as she learns that the box has got Yoko's dad in, that she starts calling the box Mr. Box.
Yeah, and refusing to put her drink down on it. Like, putting it on the floor.
It's got
that was nice.
Protective coating. It's very durable.
Yeah, we can't open it because of the curse, so it's actually a really sturdy box. That's why we use it to reach up to high shelves and whatnot.
Anti-static, it wipes clean.
A good joke, because it's just like, oh, it's just a random orange box in their house because they're poor. It's like, no, that's their dad. It's like, oh, that's really weird, because obviously the daughter's really worried. It's like, but we eat hot dinner off that and stuff. It's like, don't worry, it's protected by the magical curse that keeps him sealed away. I'm more worried now, but yeah, okay.
It's like using the Ark of the Covenant to prop up your bookshelves.
Yeah, except it's your dad as well, yeah. It's a weird one.
Yeah, another sweet, funny episode of this show.
I did like the cat thing being distracted. She hasn't got the hang of fucking inceptioning people yet, but she realizes now she can summon things because she's in dreams, and she's a succubus, is what Lilith said. And I was like, ooh, I don't like that. But there, and think of that as just like the messing with the dreams, kind of like a nightmare kind of type powers. But yeah, the thing she summons is completely useless, but enough to distract a cat or a giant muscular cat.
Yeah.
Some good bits.
Who then turns back into his normal cat form, because it's the mascot character. But then the mention of it, because Momo never sees the muscular cat, so just the mention later has Momo like pondering, the muscular cat?
I don't think we've mentioned it. This is the first time the cat like can talk in full sentences, because it's a dream world, I guess. But I do like the regular world thing, where the only thing it can say is...
It's like very ominous. I can't remember what it is now.
Yeah, it's one ominous phrase. It's like... the time is now, or something like that.
Yeah.
Or it has cometh, or something like that, is basically all it can say, and it just says that one sentence, and I can't fucking remember the sentence.
It's time to pay the price.
Yeah, yeah. It's something very like, oh, that's not good. It's like, don't worry, that's all he can say. He's got Alzheimer's, because he's a very old cat at this stage. Yeah, no, really, really fun episode again. But again, like, the plot fucking arrives and still manages to get in a bunch of jokes.
Then we've got Dr. Stone, episode 12, Buddies, back to back. We also had a extra episode of Behind the Scenes, but I did not have time to watch that.
Same.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and watch it, but yeah.
It keeps taunting me when I open the Crunchyroll browser, the website, that, oh, okay, I'll watch you this week, I promise, but then I never do. But I really must.
So they make Ginro his silver-plated blade for his spear, but it turns out this is because they need this spear to detect whether sulfuric acid fumes are about to kill them.
They need a canary for this coal mine.
It takes a lot of fun out of it for him as a result.
Yes.
I did like him complaining. He's like, why the fuck are you at the back? You're supposed to be at the front to tell us where the poisonous gas is.
Steady, come on, spear, lead me through.
So they find out where it is, and they're going to make gas masks. But Senku's like, go on his own, and that's where the Buddies back to back comes in. Chrome's like, you can't allow yourself to just do all the risks. We're in this together.
And yeah, because Senku's kind of like, I'm going to tell you all of my fucking 2 billion years of scientific knowledge. And he's like, that's dumb as shit. I should go, or we should both go.
Yes. Then he
can watch each other's
he 10 billion percents Senku back to himself.
Mm. He gets a bunch of cool manly bits in this.
Yeah, how about you tell me when we get back?
Yeah. So actually, he gets so manly in this that Yuan actually proposes marriage. I think mostly as a joke, but also as a compliment to how fucking well he's doing, how badass he's acting, I guess.
Yeah, and then we get another little bit of Kahaku's background of like why she's made herself to be super tough and strong, because she wants to be the anti-priestess so that Riri has to hang on to life.
If she inherits the role of, the 100 stories or something?
Yes, the 100 tales.
Which I'm guessing is what? Like, okay, Fist of the North Star, obviously.
Momotaro.
Those have gotten a little mixed up.
Dr. Stone, wait, what?
All the big kind of old tales of thing. If she takes that role, then her sister will lose the will to live. But since there's no one to take the place, her sister has no choice but to live with her deadly disease.
I liked how herself and Chrome both coming to the same. They're kind of similar world. You come from different ways where they don't want to like conscience society or a life where failure has to be an option. Even though it could be a logical thing to do, it's more preparing for failure, but doesn't want to, take on the role of the head priestess if it's after a scenario where her sister dies, which she won't consider unless she's done everything she can to try and save her, including this dangerous stuff and trying to find some sulfuric acid.
Hmm. It's an interesting thing, and it fits into like the theme of the show being kind of hopeful and stuff, to the point where it's just like, yeah, it would be easier or perhaps normal to accept the inevitability, but they're just outright refusing it and doing everything to fight against it.
Yeah, even when it's frightening. A lot of the like Chrome and obviously Ginro are terrified. There's a lake of like sulfuric acid here. It'll dissolve you. And he told him stories of when I'm back in my day with an expedition, there were a professor was leading his students to to this like lake of acid to study it. You notice his boot was untied. He knelt down to tie it, and he never came back up because he knelt down so low that the fumes.
It's heavier than regular air, so it collects in pockets. So this being a big pool of sulfuric acid is there's a certain level that just means breathing is death.
Mm. Yeah, and to go on the scene, like Chrome is like, oh, I'm a little bit shaky right now. Like, how are you staying so calm? Like, Senku was like, oh, it's fine, man. This guy, like, phase four, phase of fears, we've got everything on our side. If we be careful and watch each other's best, we grand. And then he sees that little quiver in Senku's hands, like, as tough and the bravado he puts on, for all of his knowledge, he's still, hesitant and anxious and fearful in the face of certain death. Well, uncertain death.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's scared, but, like, he's even saying to Chrome where it's like, you shouldn't get all, like, you should try and ignore the fear as much as you can, because that's going to affect your breathing, and that's going to affect the gas masks that we've made, and that is bad. You just need to push on ahead as if nothing has happened. And you're getting a similar kind of conversation with Kinro or Kinro?
Ginro is the little one.
Yeah. You're right. I should be freaking... Yeah, Ginro is obviously too cowardly to go back the second time. But the old man's kind of saying, it's like, yeah, you know, I used to be a coward, but you kind of have to... It's kind of like not overcoming fear. It's... I think the way he says it is like just beating it with logic and reason, doing it because you know what you need to do rather than getting over the fear. You don't get over the fear. You just need to... think past it.
Yeah, and it's not a bad thing to have. It's a natural.
It's a survival line.
And you get this like little side where we see him in his younger days. He's still this like little man with a beard, like he's like hiding away while his pack of lions are stalking by. Like, oh no, poor little Kaseki. I'm glad you got out there. I'm okay, but I felt so bad for him.
Yeah, it seems to be like his story was like, oh, I was afraid I was going to be eating my lions. So then after that day, I got ripped as fuck.
But yeah,
he didn't get any bigger, but yeah.
His younger self looks a little bit like the short guy who hangs out with Mac Mercer, I assume. I mean, obviously everybody's related in this village, but.
Yeah, a little bit.
There's probably a little bit of inbreeding, but you know, what can you do?
You'll see. That is one of the 100 tales, I do believe. He's like, oh, look at me, I've accidentally made another gas mask. I'll just leave it here.
As I was talking here, I've been just fiddling with my hands, and I guess I made a third one. Oh, well, time to step away from this and not look back.
I just turn my back, and if that gas mask disappears, then that's my own fault.
And then we get Ginro's first Narancia moment of, like, I'm not going along, I'm coming along. Just in time, because Chrome has... the ground's given way beneath him, and he's slipped and about to fall into a huge pool of sulfuric acid. I do like how sulfuric acid is anthropomorphized.
Mostly by Ginro's imagination.
Lovely angelic lady who beckons you in with her alluring shimmer and glow and color. When you get too close, it reveals its true form, a terrifying angel of death.
Yeah, like a dissolving body kind of thing. I also like the way Chrome was trying to warn Senku that a bubble burst in the sulfuric acid and popped one of his tubes, so he had to wrap it up. He's like, oh, it's a good thing you warned me, and he was rushing over to help him. But the cliff collapsed in the highly acidified rock. Yeah.
Nice little bait and switch for the view. I think that's going to be the crisis that drives Ginro to come along and save them, but it's a different thing altogether. But he saves them nonetheless.
Yeah. And they acquire sulfuric acid, which is the thing. This is the point where I realized, oh yeah, this is... I like how they often pace things so they end on a victory rather than a cliffhanger. A different show would have ended on Chrome almost about to fall into the acid, and you have to wait a week to see if he survived, and then we get like 3 minutes of the payoff, and then we'd have to move on. Whereas I actually like it better.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're absolutely right. Like, it's a better way to be, and it fits into the show's whole hopeful tone that everything ends on a high note rather than ends on a, oh, will they get out of this? It's like, yeah, we'll get out of this because they're fucking badass. And
yeah.
Because they mean, basically, yeah.
Also means next episode, now they have the ingredients, they're going to start in and do a new crazy scientific endeavor. And, show, because that's the fun part. Here comes the science and showing off what you can do with this miracle compound, to these primitive village dwellers. It's like, what? You can do what with that?
It feels like a very Minecraft thing where it's like, hey, no, you got a diamond shovel or that kind of shit, where it's just like, no, it's just like completely different thing. Now you got ramen. Now you got sulfuric acid. It's like a weird progression, yes. But it's really fun to see as well. Yeah.
You haven't just forged a lot of process in this, like, you know, okay, we'll put some sulfuric acid and you just like apply, you know, a lot of things. You've got some hydrogen in there, you put two test tubes. Eventually, like, you know, like 72 hours later, you've got some sulfur carbonate or whatever after so much distilling of different things. You know, here's what we made earlier.
And in this episode, they do a lot of callbacks. It's like, hey, remember when we talked about charcoal? We're using that as a base for this. That other stuff that we use, the sulfur that they gather from the hot springs, is like, yeah, that's going to come in useful for this regard. Like, the prior scientific inventions are helping all the new ones. And obviously, glass is vitally important here because nothing else will hold acid.
Yeah.
It's really fun to see that kind of build, and you're learning as you watch. It's great.
Yeah. And also from recent chapters of the comic, holding off on those using cliffhangers means then when you do use them, they're more powerful. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose the only cliffhanger they've done was with, and it was a good one, was with Senku.
Being quote unquote killed.
Yeah, that was a good, solid one, and it really allowed, and it wasn't more, how will he get out of this? It was more so talking about their friendship and their trust of each other.
Yeah.
Using that cliffhanger to further enforce the solidarity between these characters. Yeah.
Yeah. And it happened in the third episode, too. You kind of wonder if anybody had been a copy of Watch was watching now, I think. Do not pull in the anime episode 3 thing, but to kill out the coolest guy really early on, the rest of them have to try and get on without him. And they're not doing that again, are they?
Yeah, exactly.
They don't.
And then we've got Fruits Basket, episode 25. Summer will be here soon.
Well, in 2020, I guess, but...
I suppose, yeah.
Oh, was this end of season, was it?
End of a show. It will return at some point next year. Presumably in the summertime, so it's all thematically appropriate. And yeah, it's a nice little capper off. You get a sort of little finish to last week's story where Kazuma, Kyo's foster dad, just leaves that morning next day without a word after the whole incident previously with his transformation and such. And... Hello? Dwayne, do go on. I gotta answer this.
Oh, okay. I thought it was an alarm there. It's basically kind of going into their background and stuff and how... He initially feels that he took in the kid as kind of a penance because he only met his own grandfather who had the cat curse once before, and he kind of like he didn't treat him with kindness, and he realized the cruelty that his grandfather was treated with is similar to the cruelty that Kyo was being treated with now. And before he knew it, he loved the kid. He kind of raised him as his own. But it's the kind of thing of misunderstandings where you're just walking past the room, or you're not getting the internal monologues. You're only hearing the outside stuff where, Kyo's been berated by some teachers after school because he was being rough or something. I don't know. And it's like, oh, you think your dad would have raised you better? He's here to pick you up now. And he's like, he's not my dad. Shut up. His foster dad overhears it and thinking is like, oh, I guess we're not as close as I thought. Whereas what Kyo's internal monologue was saying was that, that he doesn't want to be, he doesn't consider himself worthy to be considered the guy's kid. It's something he feels like he needs to achieve. It's like he's unworthy of it.
You're seeing the root of his present kind of attitude when we first meet him in the show. He's not angry about people because he's just like belligerent and wants to drive him away because he just hates being out with him. He drives him away because he doesn't want to get too close to him because
he drives away the people who care about him the most as well.
I think if they know what he actually is, you know, the cat spirit and the alternate form that he has, but he has the bracelet off, they'll just quote to hate him and be disgusted by him, and then that'll hurt even worse both for him and for them. So he doesn't want to get close in the first place. So it's best that they stay away. Even for the man who raised you, and all the affection he showed onto you, he doesn't want to kind of saddle him with the burden of the association, because it would dragging his foster dad's name to the mud as well. He doesn't want that for him because he's been so good to him. He doesn't want to sully his reputation.
And it's the standard thing that is a lot in this show of people caring about other people so much that they're willing to hurt themselves in order to not hurt the person they care about, which is, that's rough, but that's love a lot of the time, unfortunately. And you're getting a lot of this as backstory while he's, Toru's walking him home, because basically, like, he left the house without saying goodbye to Kyo, and Kyo's, you know, doing the running after, teary-eyed kind of thing. When he does catch up, they kind of have a little martial arts thing that your man just fucking lays him out kind of thing. Kyo makes it pretty clear that it's like he wants to earn the right to be his kid rather than to, he doesn't consider, it's not that he doesn't consider him his father, it's that he doesn't feel like he's earned it yet, but it is something he feels like he can achieve now rather than something he will deny himself, which is the way he used to be.
He's showing him that you're the kind of man that I want to be. I can see that now for myself, and I can see like what you're trying to do as well. Like, it won't be easy. Like, no, I wanted to retreat back to my own ties with you, which is.
And he said it out loud that it was a childish thing I wanted to do rather than stand on my own two feet, which is what you obviously want from me here.
Yes,
to learn how to do that.
And he just answers back, "Kyo, my boy, my son, you're welcome to the dojo many times. You got a lot of work to do because you can't beat me yet." And he just, like, again, try have a little exchange. He's kind of fun. He's like the, I don't know, the kind of, what's that? I don't know what that move is called. It's not called a shoulder.
Like a shoulder block kind of.
You sort of kind of slammed your entire back into them and it knocks a person like flat in their ass and say, "Well, you obviously got a lot of training to do, so you better be coming back a lot more often, my son, my boy."
I do like that because basically, like, Kyo gets to say, "It's like I want to earn the right to call you dad," and he's like, "You got a long way to go, son," kind of thing. And it's just like they managed to say it to each other without saying it. Freaking manliness getting in the way of feelings. God damn it. But it was a nice moment, and you could see they're both kind of softened in it, despite literally being in a fight. It worked out pretty good.
Yeah, you can see Toru as well as a soul chuffed to see Kyo genuinely happy and joyous over something like that. He's like, "Oh, I told you someone my master was very strong." He thumbs him over the shoulder, but he's just saying kind of more so, "Check it out, that's my dad right there. I'm his son."
Yeah. How cool is he?
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of feeds into then the story surrounding that, because we've had a big breakthrough with Kyo, but Yuki's having his own little struggles in the background. He's trying to be more self-assertive in his own life, trying to be a bit
outgoing,
less shy, more outgoing at that. Mm-hmm. And you can see that Kyo he's made a big breakthrough here, and kind of in a way tries to bait him out. It's sort of a return to the usual dynamic of the household where they'll fight, if one stupid rat fucking cat will kill you, but Kyo this time he shouts at him, but he doesn't start
like he rises to the bait, but he doesn't start a fight. He just sort of stomps off angrily rather than, and even Toro's like, "Yeah, but he didn't throw a punch, so that's an improvement."
Yeah, and Yuki is feeling a little put off by that because he's sort of disgusted in himself because he feels like, "Oh, I thought I was making progress, but I see how Kyo is getting on. He's, in a way, made a more emotional progress than I have myself, because I see what he's doing. I'm getting the same ugly feelings of jealousy and envy and also the kind of disgust and revulsion because I saw his true form again out the window, and it's just that's not who I want to be, or that's like the way the old me would want to say it. I'm trying to be someone else now, and I feel kind of ashamed that I'm sort of so readily going back to those old emotions and feelings, and he's kind of questioning is what I'm doing, the way I'm going about it, the right way to do it, am I making any progress at all. He harkens back then to the Kagura, because she also appeared at Open that night. She was there, and she had also even seen Kyosuke perform before. And she also left like the following day without saying a word to pretty much anybody. She was walked out, but she kind of caught Yuki as she going out the door. Mm. And she's sort of acting normal. She doesn't seem like
she's still anything. Smiling. She's still being playful. Yeah.
Still being happy. She's kind of wondering, like, are you okay? But yeah, I'm grand. Like, some stuff went down. But it's okay. I'm dealing with it. And I'm generally kind of happy for Kyo. It's been a really good experience for him. And it's something I'm happy for him to cheer. And he's like saying, Kagura is really fighting her own fight as well. She's just trying to keep on keeping on. And, you know, maybe Kyo maybe just might not be able to return her feelings in the same way, but she's going to keep on keeping on doing her own thing and still trying to be yourself and not have anybody worry about it. He's like, God damn it. If she can do it, so can I.
Yeah, she's still maintaining the pretense, or maybe still trying a little to do the thing of chasing Kyo, but it's more so to keep appearances as normal, so Kyo can have that personal growth, whereas even if it breaks her heart, she's, again, going to put his feelings ahead of her own, that kind of way.
Yeah. Haru also kind of tossed him as well and said, man, you are right. And it's like, oh, these fucking feelings, man. It's like, I don't know how to handle it. And it's like, dude, yeah. I'm here for you. I'm looking out for you. And
he's super cool. Like, he barely shows up, but he's like, hey, everyone okay? Cool. Okay.
Yeah. Which it kind of culminates in like a little scene then where Toru's trying to find Yuki because, you know, I haven't seen him all day. Is he all right? I was worried about him earlier. And finds him then on the stairway leading up to the roof and is sort of trying to, again, keep it to pretense. But it's like, well, I'm talking to more people, though I'm smiling and being more outgoing with them. My plants aren't really dying as much anymore, so I'm paying more attention to them.
The way he's going is like, I'm making little small baby steps, but I am making progress.
I'm making changes.
I'm trying to be a better person.
And obviously a lot of that is because of you, because you've, just by your presence in my life and being there, you just improved, like, the way I see myself and the way that a lot of my other family members see myself as well. And I can see a different way out for me. I can see as well, too, that the same way that you being around can change people's lives and see the good inside themselves and make them want to improve and be better people, I can see myself by my being around the people can be beneficial as well. As my being present and alive and here right now is something that's a positive. I'm not defined by my sort of family history. That's not who I can have to decide to be going forward and show me that. And just by little, I think I can get a little closer to the person I want to be. So watch out, because I might just steal you away.
Like, he does do the thing of, like, I'm not going to be able to actually admit any feelings for you right now, because he doesn't feel, I don't know, worthy or in that kind of position. But he does do the, what the fuck, they fucking said it in Kidder the last day, the wall punch thing.
Kind of Cabadon, yeah. It's like,
yeah. He does pull that on her, and that makes her go, ooh, that's all a flutter.
Sweet swoo. I'm just joking. Or am I? Anyway, see you at dinner.
Yeah, very hot and cold. At dinner, pretty much everyone's there. All the characters you've come to know. Sheep is late, but other than that, we're good. And it's kind of all like, you know, reestablishing things. His brother is there. He's brought far too much fucking crab. And it kind of cuts to them all, and you can see the changes where they started and where they're kind of coming from. And it kind of gives you this, like, this thing where everyone's like, something's going to happen this summer, but I don't know what. Kind of like, I guess, like a teaser for the next season. But it's just like shit is changing. And like the establishing of the dinner is and everyone who's come, like, you can see how far they've come, how much they've changed. But it's interesting.
Like, I could have went to Sugar Ray, who's away at the estate. Even though he wasn't invited everybody to dinner, he's been away on urgent business.
Yeah.
And he's just there attending to Akito. He's like, oh, what's happening there? Has he come some kind of plot? Is he trying to get in close? And also we see a little bit in there because Hiro is late because he's actually been somebody in the hospital, which is, was it Rin Soma?
I think they say we're in
Rin. Yeah. I keep forgetting if that's her name or not. And just kind of talking cryptically. It's like, what was it? I gotta get out of here. I gotta get out of this hospital and gotta get to Sugar Ray. Gotta get to Gure Ni because I'm just, because he's the only one .. or I'm the only one .. It's like, ooh, an ominous portent for episodes to come in 2020. Or if you've read the comic, you have an idea of what's going to happen like I do.
But, there's also two new students put in who were just like, oh, so that's Yuki. I guess blah, blah, blah. We're going to be revealed by face in the next season or something like that.
Senior year is going to be pretty interesting, huh?
Yeah. Good, pretty good setup for like more interesting stuff. And yeah, it's still an enjoyable, fucking heartbreaking show.
Yeah.
It's a good job.
With that. It's like, no, there's a little emotional release for the end of the week. This is the kind of Yashike I can accept, I can deal with that. Maybe it's because it's an Yashike kind of anime, a healing anime that speaks to me. Also, it's going on with kind of cool characters and a little bit of comedy thrown in there as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's everything you could ask for.
Then we've got Fire Force Episode 11, Formation of Special Fire Force Company 8, / The Mightiest Hikeshi. We should get two stories for the price of one. The first is, as promised by the title, The Story of the Formation of the Special Fire Force Company 8. Hey, why don't you tell us how it happened, Hinawa?
You're the best at talking.
Okay. August 28th, solar year of 196. I remember like it was yesterday. I was in the cafeteria talking to my friend, and
he was
just relating to me, like, you know, I said, and Mackie's as well, like, there are days in the army because she shows up and they think.
Yeah, your man comments, and I was noticing, I was like, oh, she looks very skinny. This must be like when they first got recruited or something, because your man's like, wow, she's so skinny. And he's like, yeah, but she'll work really hard. But she's not cut out for the army because she's too nice.
Yes.
Yeah, they just think like, oh, she just got registered in and signed up because she's the daughter of another general. It's not reason she's here. She's cut up. But she's got the right attitude.
She will work hard, but it's just she's got the right work ethic, but she doesn't have the right attitude to be in the army. Because your man's talking, he's trying to convince your man to come to the chapel with him and get his gun blessed. Is like, because, you know, we're going to be shooting the guys, and wouldn't you rather get shot by, like, a blast gun? I would, so.
A gun's a gun, man. I don't really care one way or another. It won't matter to me until you turn into an inferno. That's very nice. Or a knife close to it. And it's like, I reach for the gun, and he's like, come on, Hinawa, I'm right here. This phone taped me out before I can turn completely. Oh, God, I heard so much. He's like, oh, I can't. He's flashing back. No one to be shot with a blessed gun. Blessed gun. It's like, I haven't got a blessed gun.
And the door bursting open and them just opening fire and him not getting to stop them, that kind of thing. That was pretty harsh.
It was really, like, nicely framed where, like, you see some of the gunfire and it's just kind of bouncing off his infernal form, but enough of it.
The flames are kind of going out in him rather than the bullets penetrating.
Yeah,
you can see they're taking effect. Yeah,
you just see Hinawa is agape, and then until the flames just sputter out. Oof.
And it was basically like the conversation at the lunchroom kind of thing, where it established that it's like, hey, there's more infernals at least, so it's not that weird that this would happen. If not that night, then soon after. But and he's also like says to his friend, is like, you know, you seem to be a cynical, cold son of a bitch, but you're actually like a really nice dude. And that's kind of like the thing for the story. Cause we've all known him as this like super cold, like stone cold killer with the bullets and everything. But
thing is, so he's not a stone
cold
killer.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not a stone cold killer because he intentionally holds back when he's discharging his gun using his powers and shoots to wound or incapacitate.
It's the fact that he actually shoots non-lethally is how his power works. Yeah,
like he's very intimidating and kind of intense to the top we meet him. As we saw last episode, we just like, here, Shinra, come help me make dinner, will you? And just to help to make him more feel at ease and to help him get what's off his mind. And because he's a pretty sound dude, he's good at just reading people and showing them the compassion they need in the right way without making it seem like you're just coming across like and overwhelming them and maybe kind of embarrassing them if that's something if you're like, subconscious about either.
It's like he was saying of your one. It's like he was impressed with her work ethic and like, oh yeah, she'll bulk up pretty quick, but she doesn't have the guts. She doesn't have the, not the guts. The
killer instinct.
The killer instinct for the army. And that wasn't, he didn't, it came across as very cynical and very like complaining about her potential. But it's like, no, she's actually very good. And obviously that comes up again later. But first, he's kind of, he takes his partner's gun. No, his friend's gun. Because he was just like, yeah, I kind of want that to remember him by kind of thing. And he comes across the scene of a fire where the blue stripes, I think, is what they tend to call the Special Fire Force, isn't it?
Yes.
The nickname.
They show up and they're like, oh, two Infernals. There's one that's sat down because it's taken it. It's still in a bit of control. And there's one that's running loose, but we got it cordoned off. And they have a points-based system for this because they're fucking assholes.
Well, yeah. We should say this is the third Special Fire Brigade.
Yeah, yeah.
This is important because we will see some of these men again in modern-day times at some point. So these are the people who work under Giovanni, the creepy plague doctor-dressed guy.
Okay.
The guy who exudes being evil.
And the guy who's running down the scene on hand is regular Fire Force, regular firefighter,
Obi.
Obi,
I think he's not a captain in this, is he?
He's just some guy.
I don't think he's even like a captain at this stage. He's just on that fire.
The ranking officer at the scene.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
Under control. He's like, okay, step out of the way, you little fire. We'll take care of the real threat. You can just like spray your little hoses afterwards.
It's basically that, yeah. You guys get ready with the water. We got firepowers. Whatever, dude.
Meanwhile, there's like a woman there pleading with them. Look, my husband is inside. He's right there. He hasn't quite turned all the way. If you go in right now, you can save him from this torment. It's like, whatever, lady. He's going to be on fire in half an hour anyway. We're going to take care of the other more dangerous, more valuable environment. We'll get right back to you in just a little.
The other guy's worth more points. You got to understand, it's a points-based system. And even Obi trying to stand up.
Sorry, citizen. It can't be helped.
Yeah, he says he'll take care of it himself. And obviously our soldier boys are overhearing this and is like, you're going to try and take out Infernal yourself? He's like, yeah, I got a big axe. And he's like, I'm coming with you. So they both kind of go in and lay out the way they feel about this. He lets them know. So I was like, hey, have you ever fought an Infernal before? Because I'm a regular firefighter and I have not. And he's like, I couldn't kill my friend who turned
just
into
once.
One. But, yeah, and the guy's there just screaming in the sitting room kind of thing. So he's gotten the axe out and ready to go, but your man's like, okay, I got a blessed gun. We'll say the prayer and we'll get through it. And it's just like one shot, so, you know, as merciful as you can be, it's a terrible scenario.
Mm-hmm. That's the kind of occurs with this strike out in the room, because you want to have a branch of the fire force that caters to the actual needs of the people and is compassionate about the suffering and the loss of both the victims of human combustion and their families and loved ones who were left behind.
Yeah, because Obi even says, like, beforehand, it's like, it's not about whether or not he believes in Saul. It's not about whether he's religious. It's about respect. That's why you say that. Yeah.
Any human empathy in your soul at all.
you say the prayer not because you believe in God or heaven or hell or anything like that, but because you respect the people here and you respect the last rites, essentially.
And also because the creator wanted a sexy nun.
Yeah, obviously. You got to get a sexy nun in there. And where did you get the sexy
firefighter
nun?
Firefighter nun.
That's one of the things I enjoyed about this episode is the complete lack of that fucking shite.
That's a little bit stronger for us.
Are you sure? Because I've looked at Twitter and I believe this is the episode which introduces the character people want to fuck.
What?
Or not introduces him, but he is featured mainly in this episode.
Oh, but I mean, like, there's no cheesecake in the episode.
No, people really are taken with Betty Barrow.
No, that's a different thing. Like, you just showing him being a badass, and it's like, that's attractive. I mean, like, seeing him compromised in the shower kind of fucking thing. I mean, like, again, I wouldn't mind that scene because it's a nice, at least everyone gets the beefcake and the cheesecake. Do both, goddammit.
You mean more or less so, all of her clothes get burned off, but it's all done in the best possible taste.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he had his shirt accidentally pulled off.
He did take off one of his sleeves, over. I guess, as well. Yeah.
Where those two. Are they girls? I don't know who they're, what their relationship is.
I assume they have fire powers because they have fire themed, hems to their sleeves.
But yeah, I did, when they hide behind his back and they're holding onto his top, but anyway, he stands up, it just falls off because their weight pulls it off. Company 8 have just wandered into Company 7's jurisdiction because they know Company 7 don't like doing things by the book, so they won't bother either.
It's like, well, we know if we made an appointment, you wouldn't fucking see us, so we just shut up. You got a deal now.
Yeah. There to investigate the scene of an old case, actually the first case that the 8th Company ever investigated themselves, and I think there could be a valuable clue there as to the rest of the investigation going forward. But
The other thing in the flashback was the first recruit was Mackie, isn't it?
It was like Hinawa and Obi. Like, here's our firehouse. Yeah. It's that's you punk of shit, but we're making our own. We got to think about like staffing this thing. And Hinawa's like, I think I've got somebody in mind for the job.
Yep, she's badass, but like she's compassionate, which is exactly what the fuck we want. And here in the present is like, really? You think that about me, boss? Oh man, it was really nice. But yeah, they're here to investigate I guess like open up the old case of the first thing they investigated, because it was a bit suspect. There was a weird cross. The guy was in white robes. That takes on a new significance now.
Obviously. You call it a cold case, but
yeah.
It wasn't really quite work considering the cause of death and all that.
But they figure it's actually related to stuff based off the, what are they calling them, the white robes or something now? They have a term for it, but I can't think of what it is.
The white clad. The white hoods, I can't remember.
Something like that, yeah. But it's like that changes the context of that, because it was like he'd know next of kin. It was like fairly hushed up after, and I was like, that seems suspect now. It seemed suspect at the time, but they'd nothing to go on off of it.
Yeah. Also, the Fire Force came, or a company, and just pillaged his house of all belongings. Oh, was it a Fire Force or something else? Somebody else did. It came in and just cleared all his belongings in house. And
it was the company he worked for, I believe, which still exists. I'm not sure if that's the company that actually has their own Fire Force. I've forgotten, but it was his work basically came and cleared out all his personal belongings, which seems a bit weird. But yeah, they're here to investigate that crime. But there's a fire. Well, there's a Infernal, more specifically, with in this district, I guess, which is a very traditional district, wouldn't you know?
Yeah, so you get traditional firemen who wave around as those big, I don't know what to call them.
Poles. I've forgotten the name again.
It is it's kind of more so here. You can kind of see the pro-American comparisons that were made at the start of this. Now that film has been released and more people know about it. But I think, you can cite traditional fighters as an influence or an inspiration for your visual theme in a lot of different things. This is just Dennis the Menace, both UK and US versions. It's like, here's a similar idea that we happen to come up with on two opposite sides of the globe, and it's just turned out that way. We had no idea what was happening.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Then we see that, old lady, wanted to see the guy be put to rest. And we generally get an idea of, like, how well loved he is in his district.
Oh, yeah, because everyone's coming up to him and he's like, hey, buddy, even the guy who turned infernal was like, hey, man, let's go get drunk. And he's like, no, not now, dude. And then he's kind of regretting it after. Well, it was in the same day, so it's not like he was going to go out in the middle of being on duty, but yeah.
He was going to think about it, though.
Yeah.
Before you even had a chance of properly replying to him, he's already gone. So I got to be the one to take him out.
Most explosive way possible.
This is a fireball and saying, home's going to be rebuilt, considering them are offering to the... offering to the gods to the great flame for sparing our own lives. We can all rebuild houses and let the spirits of the victims of human combustion be laid to eternal rest.
Because the guy's third generation pyrokinetic, he says, is like, oh, he's a third and a second generation. I guess that's the two eyes thing, because they make a point of showing that. Where he can make fire, but also control fire in some regard. So he explodes an entire city block, like, what do they call that thing where they burn part of the grass, like in a controlled fire, so a wildfire can't spread? Like, he basically takes out the city block around this guy so that it can't spread to any further of the city.
Yeah.
I forgot what the term is.
Yeah,
that's fire control. Yeah.
It's the standard procedure for the Edo era.
Oh, that's what they used to do as well, is it? Except, obviously, yes. Not with huge pyrotechnic kicking those fucking giant poles into things.
Oh, actually, no. Yeah, you're right. They would just, like, pull the house down altogether. So it was a short piece.
So it's traditional methods,
yes.
Inverted commas heavy, that he's using as well. Yeah,
yeah. I've watched a short piece there, and has the combustion segment and that, and basically had a duke up a height of points in. The fire's over there, so he's got to pull down that house on the corner of Tanaka Street, and that should
so it can't spread to that it. Way. Yeah, okay. That's pretty cool.
I never actually kind of copped that the third generation was all about the emissions in various ways, and then second was all about controlling it. Well, Shinra, you know, he can shoot jets out of his feet, but he can control the more or less the intensity of them rather than manipulate them and cause them to do different things or like
it's more so how he physically moves using those jets of fire. Yeah,
and like Arthur, he emits a flame, but it's in the form of a plasma sword. But he can't really like make that flame just go off in crazy angles where it wouldn't normally be able to do. Like
the variation seems to be, he seems to be able to make tiny swords or big swords. That yes. Seems to be the variation he got. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas obviously Benny Murray can make a one of those big poles go on fire with it by his own flame, and then like. Launch it into the air and just basically turn them all into warheads that can just demolish entire houses on their own.
That and launch himself into the sky like some sort of rocket-powered witch or something, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than two recap episodes, it's not on for 2 weeks, which gives us a breather to watch some new stuff.
Yeah, it'll give us a thing to determine what needs to get cut, I suppose.
If anything.
Yeah.
Then we've got Hakata Mentai, Pirika Rakachan, episode 12. It's a festival. Everyone assemble. Oh no. Pirika Rakachan is going to be the lead singer at the festival, but she's lost her voice. Quick. Get some honey for her voice from this particular island where you can get honey in Hakata.
Who the fuck was that character? Was that someone who won like a contest to be on this show? What was that about?
I don't know.
David Pirikarajan, and it's like, that guy? It's like, yes, me, that guy, who's always been in the show up to this point. And I was like, who the fuck are you?
Anyway, he gets the hoodie.
Yeah.
It works. She gets her voice back. But she's terrible at singing. We never said she was good at singing. No.
Yeah.
And then she turns to camera and says, please visit our shopping arcade.
It was a big ad. Who knew? I was getting the, I was going to say freaking Bono, but, the other seal, not the, Shonen Ishiba, he could never fucking sing. He sings like a child and she sings like a child. I was getting that kind of vibe. So that was funny.
That was it. That was the episode.
Yep. A lot of callbacks, all the characters you love lending a hand in some regard, but yeah.
Vinland Saga, episode 11, a gamble. But first of all, let's mention that we entirely forgot to talk about the dream sequence in episode 10.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's because we got caught in like the rhythm of the thing as going that we lost the out of play stuff, but the thing that sets context, yeah.
Yeah, so we Thorfinn in episode 10, as well as all the stuff we discussed, has a dream of him talking with his dad, but they're in a land that he doesn't recognize.
And he's a little kid again.
He's a little kid. It's warm and fertile. They get a bit of discussion. When he wakes up, we get a bit of discussion about how fertile England is, but it's not warm like this. But clearly, it's the description of Vinland that Leif Erikson gave him in the first episode.
Yeah. And this is what he's sticking. This is...
forgotten what it was that he's remembering, but it's drawing him. It's calling to him.
Mm.
Yeah.
And also his dad's words about not getting into fights and turn your back on violence.
Yeah, which he's got like a little bit of experience with now after getting the shit knocked out of him by Thorkell. And then all the guys saying, oh, you're coming with us now, Thorfinn. We'll go on, go up, up the country. We'll fight some English guys. Like, what the fucking idiots. These guys are lunatics. War isn't fun at all. What are these guys talking about?
Yeah.
Which is then reflected in episode 11 with Ragnar's rant about, you stupid Vikings, you're just gonna get yourselves killed.
And they're all like, good, we'll get the fucking Valhalla then.
Yes. And yeah, cause it's clearly about like how, religion is a tool to manipulate people. It's clearly like all these Vikings, generations after generation, they've been fed these myths to motivate them into
just throwing
fighting
their
without
in.
Fear.
Yeah,
yes.
Mm. And you can see it's very much so about like the cultural difference, because they keep mentioning is like, oh, what's your favorite thing about England? I like the beer. I like cheese with the beer. They make some good cheese and cheddar. I like them English ladies. They're attractive ladies, and it's like, you're a creepy Viking.
They're all Christian and coy, and when they go like, ooh, don't look at me, and they're all embarrassed. That's really
And your
cute.
Man's like, oh, maybe I should convert to Christianity, and they're all like, ah, no, it's a load of bollocks, man.
Let's ask the priest.
And they're like,
we got, and Thorkill's there. It's like, hey, we got a Christian here. It's like, hey, who'd win in a fight, Jesus or God?
I've seen Jesus in that guy.
Oh, yeah, he asked later about the Jesus or God thing, because, yeah, who'd win in a fight, Jesus or Thor? Even one of the Vikings going like, I saw a statue of him in London, and it's like, you look like a skinny motherfucker. Thor kick his ass. What are you talking about? Hmm.
And to which the priest's answer is, whichever one invented beer.
Yeah.
Good answer. It's just mad crack on the road with the lads, having the laughs, and Ragnar and all the rest of their, like, anybody of inner the fuck kind of like, what the fuck, these guys. They're going off talking about, when I get to Lancaster, I'm going to murder 500 Englishmen. Oh, I'm going to murder 600 Englishmen. Oh, yeah. It's like, geez. It's a mad laugh with the lads on the road as it discusses openly murdering the population.
Yeah, and even Ragnar's like, okay, like, I get your Thorkell and shit, but you're like 500 dudes and you're going up against an army of like, what, 2,000 or something like that? You're fucked. But, and they're like, yeah, it's good.
Got one Thorkell though, which is all we need.
Yeah, yes. Pretty much.
Also, it turns out there's only 400 dudes, with the army they meet, and they hand over their hostages because Thorkell's like, okay.
It's like, it'd you have them now, I'll give them back to you, but can you keep them?
Yeah, I did like your man's reaction where he was like, hey, give us the hostages, you won't be... Oh, thank you. I guess you're actually pretty reasonable. Right. And Thorkell's like, well, see, now you're not massive fucking wusses and you don't have the excuse of, oh, they had a hostage, we couldn't attack them. It's like, because we gave you the hostage, so now we're fucking fighting.
Damn,
unless you're going to walk away, you walk away, buck, and all the Vikings are like, oh, let's fuck them up. You know, your man's just like, Ragnar's, we should mind the prince.
Idiots, we got a mission to get the guy out of here.
He just called us chicken, man. We can't
he's
take that. We're Vikings.
I'm a superior officer. We're pulling a fall back. No way, dude.
He's making clucking noises and waving his arms like a chicken, implying that we're the chickens.
But no, it's great though, because it's on both sides though. It's not like,
yeah.
This is the problem that Ragnar and Canute have identified within the Viking condition.
These fucking Vikings.
But as it is, Askeladd is also slightly off stage with a much more cunning plan.
Burn it all!
We'll burn the whole forest down, then they won't know who's what, and whoever fucking survives, we can fucking kill, and if the prince burns down, we'll just say, oh no, there was a forest fire, we weren't there though, so, I don't know. Everybody wins, I guess.
Also, maybe we'll see if Thorfinn can just swoop in there.
Thorfinn, go into that forest fire and get me the prince.
Well, first of all, we're going to tip two buckets of water over you to make you immune to fire.
They should have tipped some buckets over that fucking horse as well. Like, what the hell?
But Bjorn points out, why are you sending in Thorfinn by himself? Do you think he can succeed? You think he actually can't? You're starting to trust the little bastard, ain't you?
No way, man.
No comment.
Baka.
Then Thorfinn ends up in front of Thorkell again, and Thorkell reveals that he knows who Thorfinn is, but he doesn't reveal to Thorfinn his connection to Thorfinn yet.
I know you're mad. You're mad as Helga, ain't she? Ah.
yeah, it's like meeting an old buddy on the playground, and he's like, hey, whoa, before we get down to the brass tacks of us fighting to the death, how about we have a little chat in the middle of this forest fire? Because it's like, oh, we got a connection, you and me. I'll kill you next time, bud.
Forest is burning now. Probably isn't the right time for this. Catch you later. I'll see you down there, because we're all heading the same direction.
Yeah.
I'll see you there.
You got the prince. You're probably going to bring him back to the king. That's where I'm going to fight to the death. So, cool. See you later, bud.
Then Asgard catches it with the Prince of Ragnar, swears allegiance, apologizes for getting a bunch of Ragnar's men killed in the fire.
Yeah, Ragnar's like, you're in big trouble for setting fire to the forest, but you're the only army we have, so I'm commissioning you to protect the prince. Yeah. It's like a weird situation of, ooh, you're in such trouble. Congratulations, you are the royal army now.
The prince takes his helmet off, and all the Vikings are like, are we sure this isn't a princess?
Whoa.
I think he's supposed to be like the same age as Thorfinn, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think you were saying before. Or at least in and around the same age, yeah.
Different lives. He's probably maybe a little bit older. I think Thorfinn is a little bit younger than me, discerning to be. It's just had a much harder childhood. Much harder part of the childhood than...
Yeah, but Thorfinn is a short ass as well, though.
That too.
Yeah.
Once he's firmly in adulthood, he's still a short ass. Which then, because that's obviously the juxtaposition of his father and Thorkell is, yeah, he has not inherited their height.
Yeah,
but his sister has, but he has not.
Yeah, but he's compact and deadly like a bullet.
Yes. That's where we leave us.
Some impressive gore, massive violence in the episode, besides a guy just like getting the javelin, just blowing his entire head off. Also seeing Thorkell's favorite method of attacking guys is getting a big long axe in each hand and just turning into a human blender and eviscerating anybody who walks into his path.
Yeah, that pretty much has your gore covered, I think, for the whole show.
I'm going to start axing like this, and if you get chopped into a million pieces, it's your own fault.
Yeah, human blender, all right, is the right way to go.
Now we've seen enough of Thorkell. Otsuka's doing a different performance than Blackbeard, because Thorkell, while he has plans, he never comes across as cunning and as intelligent as Otsuka's Blackbeard performance does.
He's murdered.
Yeah.
So maybe we should get Aki Otsuka to do, I don't know, play some old man for it. No, you're going to have, even if Goku was like coming like an old, wizened old dude, you still want to get Masako and Nezahua to do it. But you can see what could have been this in a parallel universe.
Next up, we've got all the Toei stuff. Let's start with Rio Solga, FC27, the unbeaten, unrivaled fists. They've got this map. It's going to show them where another one of the Dino Knights is. They quickly find him, but he's not coming out of his mountain until they find his kid. And so they've got to go looking for the kid. They find him down a hole. Meanwhile, they still want to deal with the monster from previous, but actually they're not in that so much. It's more focusing on the generals reappeared, and he mentions that when he got blown up last time, he actually flew off into space. And they say, oh, he ran away. So no, it was a tactical retreat. But he ran into him, who also is planning on conquering the Earth. And he's darned if he's going to let him conquer the Earth before he does. So clearly there's another villain coming along later who's worse than the Druidons. And he also seems to be shook up. He's less bossy. He's got like a vocal tick he didn't have before. He's being blown up and shot into space and meeting somebody more evil than him has shook him up somewhat. We get a lot of stuff is hit to do with the Nada, the guy who wanted to be the Red Ranger. And he's like trying to convince Ko that, well, you're the red one. You're in charge. You shouldn't go down that hole. You should tell one of the others two to go down the hole because you're the leader. Anakin's like, we don't have a leader. We're all equal. But if I say I'm going down this hole, I'm going down this hole. And he goes down the hole, finds the son of the other dinosaur. He manages to get him out, but he's stuck in there himself. And so they end up, the two united form a new power, they get a new power up, one of the things which go into the sword. And then that forms like a big sort of armored boxing armor, with the dad on one shoulder and the son on the other. And then meanwhile, the full-sized version of them beats up the now much larger monster. There's also like a little bit with Nada, because the dad's trying to take a photo of this map, but he won't let him take the photo. So there's definitely something up with that kid. Or that old, not a kid, he's an old man. He's probably 400 years old as opposed to 300.
Old child.
And yeah, they defeat the monster, they run away, Geysorg insults the general some more, he also gets like he also has to repeat the running away thing, so I ought to, smash that armor, and Geysorg's like, well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind you doing that, because I can't get out of this armor myself. So there's like, so clearly some regret there, so, which also suggests that he's not Nada if he can't get out the armor. And like maybe Nada's going to turn out to be the villain, and Geysorg will be the turn out to be the next member of the team. We shall see. And I don't think anything else majorly plot wise occurred within this situation. Oh yeah, and Canelo fails to hit on the woman who was the source of the monster. He tries wooing her with a line, and she just ignores him. And then the other guys come and repeat that line back at him as some sort of consolation. Not so much really consolation, just to rub it in that he can't find a wife, even though he's desperate to find a wife. Apparently next week someone gets shrunk, because it's called the microscopic conflict.
Nanomachines.
Exactly. And next up, though, we've got Star Twinkle Pretty Cure. Which episode is it, Niall? Two episodes? One episode?
It's two and one. You have Our Feelings as One, The New Power of Imagination for episode 32, and Puff's Determination, the Operation Lend a Hand. So we find out how to fill out the rest of the season, the rest of the series even. So Puff, Fuwa, they've evolved into a new form. There's a little kind of knockoff unicorn thing. It's like, oh, it's pretty nice. It's so cute. However, this is only its mid-stage form. It hasn't evolved into the end goal gate. You've got to give it a few more levels and use a moonstone on it. No. It's more so like you have to raise it up properly and write whatever that means. Princesses are being very, very vague about what that actually entails. So this, I guess, means to bestow your values and good nature upon it. It's some concept called Twinkle Imagination. Just go and find out what that is, what that means. We won't tell you. We probably don't know. We're not going to tell you anyway. It must be discovered. Can't be shown what it is. And that will unlock a new power that will help you defeat all the evil and save the galaxy. It's like, okay. Well, I guess we'll take this home then and try and figure this out. So I guess we've got to try and raise this Pokemon. And Fuwa, Puff, she's in the terrible twos now. She's going, well, why do you gotta go to school for? I wanna play. I wanna find Twinkle Imagination. I'm sorry, Puff, we got out of the school. Summer's over. I'm behind on my summer homework and I'm gonna, like, I kinda have to take extra classes if I don't do this. It's like, oh man, why do you gotta go to school? I'll help homework. No. You don't stop. You're walking on over it. Ah, just stay still for 1 minute, please. Be a good girl. Okay, why are you boring? I'm going to play with Elena and Madoka. Oh, why? Madoka's got student council, and Elena's got to help her mom at the flower shop. You know, no one wants to play with me. I found Twinkle Imagination. It's just, it's being a bit of a brat and trying to help out and butt in like a bad dog always where they shouldn't be. And it's sort of, I feel this episode that says, look, kids, your parents can't always have time to play with you, but they do important things like paying bills and making sure the house is paying the rent and the mortgage and all that, and also making sure that space pirates don't come and invade and destroy all we hold dear. Just little things like that. Doesn't mean we don't think that playing with you is important or whatever like that. It's just got to try and find balance in our lives for all these things. You know? So maybe don't be so hard on your folks, you know? So there'll probably be a lot more of that. They have access to a new combination attack. Get some new costumes or crowns. It's pretty cool. But to kind of, I guess, unlock the full potential that they to teach this little Pokemon how to be a more well-rounded, fluffy mascot character. Galogre is still about. He's doing his warping thing. Even though he's failed for the last time, he's going to get another chance after that again to try and kill them Precures. Again, a bit of his backstory as well is that his planet was destroyed and he was cast adrift in space. He had to watch his snow crumble and be consumed by its own very core. And then not long after that, Darkness, the evil lord, appeared and said, "I have a place for you. You have been cast aside by the universe. Come with me and we will reshape this galaxy in our own image." And I'm getting the sense as well, because that also drew in Cappard and Tengu lady, whose name I forget. And I get the impression that it's probably Darkness going around the universe, destroying planets to try and sow all of this discord and despair and sadness, so he can more easily recruit people to his cause of spreading more darkness and spread across the entire universe. Mm. So nonetheless, they're going to, but first of all, they got to figure out as well how to even get to the planet where their home base is. They were never able to reach it anyway. It's in some areas which can't be accessed, but the space patrol is going to hang around. They're going to be camped out behind, behind Jupiter or something like that. So if the Precure's named him, give him a ring. So yeah, it's just kind of to set up a dashboard, maybe going for episode and probably learning a valuable lesson about yourselves that will help Fuwa to develop and develop their feelings and discover whatever they need to do to unlock the true potential and defeat the evil bad guys. To that extent, there's lots of this as well. But also some villainous acts in the episode 33 there, where Capper turns up and he does this thing where he can absorb someone's negative emotions and turn into a weapon. In this case, not a scorned classmate or a down or underlook film director or anything like that. This absorbs the negative emotions of the dog, of the guy who's dog Yeti at that one, and then turns him into a weapon, a sword and shield that can bark and shoot sonic waves at that. What negative emotion does the dog have? Also, you're a pretty evil villain jerk to do that to the dog in the first place, but what's the dog feeling bad about? I shat in the carpet and I was made to feel ashamed about it, so I was cast outside and I'm feeling really guilty about it, or I was eating out of the bin again, and I feel so ashamed that I can't help myself.
That's pretty evil, man. All dogs are good dogs. That's bad.
But they can feel sad. They can feel lonely. I guess that's
negative.
They can be exposed and then drawn to that. So that's our mid-season power, but also the villains are stepping up their evil activities as well. So watch out, or darkness ahead for the pretty curious.
Then we've got Kamen Rider 01, episode 4. And I've copied over what the title of it was. Let me undo all this. Ah, there we go. Redo that. The bus guide saw it. The truth about Anna. So, in this episode, we get to the bottom of what happened in Daybreak City 12 years ago when it blew up. And it starts off with Anna, this tour guide, Huber Gear, that they're testing out, is taking a bunch of school children on a tour past the quarantined area for when the city blew up, and they're explaining what happened, and then a bunch of these kids go, "No, it was caused by this kid's dad. He was the one who was he was delinquent at work and caused the entire city to blow up." And then the cop shows up. I'm trying to remember his name. I know I've got Aruto's name remembered, but I can't remember the cop's name. Isamu shows up and he's like, "No, it wasn't this kid's dad who did it. It was the blasted Huber Gears. They're evil, I tells you."
I was going to say which cop, but I said I'd wait for the racism and see.
And, so he shows up and he's like, and he's like, "Hey kid, do you want to go and investigate the city with me and we'll find out the truth and prove your dad didn't blow the city up?" This is after, though, they first get attacked by the bus driver, who is turned into a bad guy by the bad guys. But they were able to defeat him because it can fly. So that means the secretary has to go and speak to the satellite to 3D print off a new power-up for 01. And the other cop comes along and says, you can't take a kid into the sealed-off area, but if you are going to take a kid out of the sealed-off area, take this power-up with you. And behave like a cop. He's like, I don't have to behave like a cop, I've got the day off.
Wait, so he's taking a kid to a crime scene while he's not a cop?
Yes, he's taking a kid to a 12-year-old crime scene, which is quarantined by the government.
That's a pretty extreme cold case, all right.
Even before they've gone, the moment they set foot in there, they're attacked by rogue humor gear.
Just need a fresh pair of eyes on the scene.
That's probably why it's quarantined, if there's that many fucking loose robots there, yeah.
Okay, yeah, meanwhile, what do you see?
Out of the tour guide's like, well, I need some more information, because there's some gaps in the information. I can't be a tour guide properly without all the proper information. So they go and speak to the guy who wants to be the CEO. And they goes, what really happened 12 years ago? And he's like, I can't tell you. Some things have got to be left in the shadows for the good of a business. Which we're getting now. Social satire and commentary on the Japanese business practices.
Black company.
Yeah, so Arusha's like, well, I'm going to go investigate myself. Come with me, Anna. We're going to go to the Daybreak City. And so they all run into each other at the same time. But the cop's like, yeah, you blooming hidden intelligence, you're just covering stuff up, you know the truth. And he's like, I don't know the truth. And to prove to himself, to prove to Isamu that he's not going to cover things up, he transforms into 01 in front of him, much to the secretary's annoyance. He's like, that's supposed to be secret. He's like, I can't keep secrets. That's where we got into this mess in the first place, is the company keeping secrets. And so they both go and investigate. They have to fight off the Kamen Rider, the monster for a bit. And they manage to recover a memory chip from a Huma Gear, which shows that the Huma Gears had already gone berserk and were destroying everything. And basically the dad sealed off the Huma Gear factory and self-destructed it. So he's not responsible for blowing up the city, just the factory to prevent the rogue Huma Gears getting, even more out of control than they did. And they're like, excellent, we've got some evidence now. And also in doing this, there's like a broadcast that he received from the terrorist organization claiming responsibility. So they're like, okay, great, we know what's happened. But then, during this though, Anna's been transformed into whatever the mob Huma Gear bad guys are. And she fights it to show them this footage, but then she gets destroyed. Like, completely wiped from existence by, not the giggling one, the other one of the terrorist organization, who has his own Kamen Rider belt, because he does this as a Kamen Rider.
Gasp.
Yes, but then, regardless of not having the evidence, Aruto calls a press conference and, no, doesn't, you know, he just contacts the news services and the news report on it. And the cop is like, okay, begrudgingly admits that this guy isn't as bad as he thought he was, and then he tells him a joke, and then he has to, like, stifle his laugh as he wanders off. And then the great bit is as it cuts to credits, you hear, just at the start of the credits, him laughing off-screen. He's finally got away from Aruto, so he can finally admit that he found the terrible joke that he told him hilarious. There's like a hint at the start when they're doing the official history of what happened is the city was like built by multiple corporations, one of which has got like the same size logo as the Hidden Intelligence. The Zaya Enterprises, who, according to publicity materials, also have a Kamen Rider called Kamen Rider Thalsa. Can you trust Kamen Rider named after Seltha from Fist of the North Star? Probably not.
Well, he did it all for love.
I'm going to guess he's probably the person we saw in Shadows at the end of episode 3. Yeah, I really enjoyed this so far. It's Obviously, part of it feels like because Zio was so bad that this might seem even better in relation to that.
Washing the tears out of your mouth.
Yeah, but general production, the fighting, the costumes, the acting. Like, it's X-Aid I liked, which was the same team. But I think, well, X-Aid had, like, a couple of really, well, one really good actor and one guy who turned out to have, like, a fantastic range of manic acting, which was great. This feels like, throughout the cast, it's pretty good. And yeah, I hadn't realised it's the guy who wrote those Kawake Lupans and Lupan Part 4.
Oh.
Is the guy who wrote this at X-Aid. Yeah.
It's hard to pull calls this production, huh?
Yep. Then we've got One Piece, episode 902. The Yokozuna appears, the invincible Urashima goes after Okiku, in which we cover about 8 pages of the comic.
Yeah, didn't this happen last week? I remember misremembering things.
I feel like we've gotten back to the old One Piece pace again, yeah.
Well, all they did was pad out the sumo fight.
There was some looped animation. I kept noticing it because they kept fucking looping it.
And extending one joke, which was great because they actually made the joke funnier by extending it, which is the bit where they're both teetering over the edge of the ring.
I was fine with them bringing that, like showing the audience reactions. It's like it kind of got funnier as it went on. It's like, okay, yeah, I get it. And then it got funny again.
And Miyubi Tanaka's voice acting as Luffy teetering on the edge. It's hilarious.
Yeah. No, I have no problem lengthening that bit. That was some solid comedy. Like,
but yeah, most of the lengthening was just Luffy dodging constantly. Meanwhile, we get a little bit of like, we're going to get that dumpling out of your cheek, little girl. If my name's not Hold'em. And then eventually Luffy just goes, ooh, gum gum, sumo slap. And, basically makes a fist, like a slap almost as big as the sumo wrestler, and fires him across the city, hitting Hold'em's hideout.
Like, it seems like it's like Luffy should really be taking care of this other problem across town. But he's doing a twofer.
Unknowingly.
Yeah. I mean, like, you could say it's Haki that's allowing him to do it. It's like, nah, it's probably just complete fucking accident, but that's how he rolls.
No, this is the man who'll be king of the pirates, Trent. He's
doing it on purpose. It's
no
all part
wasted
of the plan.
Motions at all.
I did like how they had Hold'em's human face freaked out by the proximity of the sumo wrestler's face to his face, and then his lion face on his belly freaked out by the proximity of the sumo wrestler's belly to his face.
It was a good comparison, yeah.
Oh, the
there were some bits that worked good. Like, I think all the sumo wrestling stuff worked pretty good, where Luffy's like officially challenging him, and your man's just like, what? No, I'm not doing any official challenge. all his special moves are cheating moves.
Oh, to be fair, I'm not sure how many of Luffy's would be legal in sumo wrestling.
Dude, there's nothing against stretching your arm a mile behind you, inflating the bones, and slapping the dude with a hand
being
the size
knocked
of
an incredible distance out of the ring, and then just using your stretchy arms to pull yourself back.
I think
into
it's like
ring.
A Dragon Ball situation. As long as your feet don't touch the ground, you're good. Like, that's standard martial arts thing. It's like once their feet touch the ground outside of the arena, like they fucking pull that shit in Super, like on the way back, where it's like, oh, Vegeta was standing on a crumbled piece of the stage.
Yes.
I was like, that's bullshit. That's definitely standing outside the stage.
I'll allow it.
I'm curious how they get what would you call it? They've got like a floating, roof above the ring that just seems to float in midair.
I assume it's like, it's strung across some rope or something, but you don't quite see how the fuck it's attached.
No, there's nothing to show, but, I wonder if it's going to be turned out to be another metal which allows you to float that we've not come across yet.
I'll have to go back and check the comics, but surely this is the length of it, the way to see if anything's holding that thing up.
Yeah.
Well, it's just one of those little details that it'll be all explained later on, like Haki was.
Exactly,
like,
yes.
You saw Haki just manifested in different ways. You thought, oh, this is a move that one villain had, so this isn't like a technique that anyone can learn. Actually, no, you can do that. Similar to like the Cypher Police had the six powers, the know, to walk on air and turn to buy and steal. But anyway, I can learn how to do that. I can, even outside of the cipher police, like Sanji did with the moonwalk. The dance, but the jumping walking off the air, midair. Yeah. Like, I like that. There was like a internal logic, to, if as much as One Piece can we kind of have internal logic anyway to a lot of devices and things that it does.
You just mightn't find out how it works for years and years. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you may like see, but obviously like the idea of like the, once we saw, Raleigh give that stare and you're like, oh, that's the stare Shanks did in the very first chapter.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, he's not pulling these things out of his ass. They actually are like, deceded very early on, and if you didn't notice it, then it's your own fault.
Yeah, it's even crazier in the comic at the moment, but we're a while off that.
Yeah,
it's like people who just cancel descriptions of the papers are for the good of their blood pressure, because it seems like you know, any chapter really people open the paper, it's just the latest shocking news. I suppose it's a nice little like mirror of our own world where you can't like turn on the radio or open the paper without some atrocity being spread across the front page.
But yeah, that made me love Big News Morgans even more, though, as both the character, once we realized, oh yeah, this guy's gonna go into fisticuffs, but you got that to wait, anime watchers. Then finally we've got Gegege no Kitaro episode 73. Hang on, I've
said 74. The fall of 74,
that's because I underdid things to see my Kamen Rider chapter. Actually that was One Piece episode 903, a climactic sumo battle. You're right about thinking you'd heard
that before. Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about
Straw Hat versus the strongest ever Yokozuna.
Well, it's just like,
it's still sumo fighting, and it was still sumo fighting last week. So I can see, like, I was like, that sounds like last week's one, but it's very close. It's adapting only a couple of pages.
Find and replace terms.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's because Letting Light on Magic, Dwayne produces a list of titles, but he did not have the Kamen Rider title. I pasted it over where I'd written the Kamen Rider title, so I had to control Z to get the title back. I hadn't realized.
Well, I was meaning more the One Piece writer's room. There's like, well, we call it episode. We'll call it episode Luffy fights the Yokozuna. How about the Straw Hat Captain has a fracas with the Yokozuna
champion?
That's different enough.
Like, next week is going to be Luffy, winner of the sumo match. it's just like, yeah, okay. We get it. You really slowed down the pace.
Kitaro, episode 74. The fall of the underworld? Tamamono Mai's trap. So, I was like, oh, it is just her doing it. And then I looked at the episode title for episode 76 and I still don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Maybe I was right.
Like, she straight up admits to it, like, really offhandedly, and I was like, that can't be right. That doesn't seem...
But yeah, if you look at episode 76 title, it was like, maybe Brian was right in his predictions, or maybe it's entirely unrelated and he's just going to show up in episode 76 as the start of the next time.
That's entirely feasible as well, I guess, yeah.
She is starting a war with
Korea.
Country. Yes, it's not country, it's like province.
Oh yeah, B or something. Like a principality A or something like that. Yeah, they don't specify what kind of a country it is, but it's like, it can't be anywhere other than North Korea, right?
How many detectives do you know to have a border onto the Sea of Japan?
Let's see, the United States.
Libya Libya's not this particularly far away.
dear.
Yeah.
But yeah, the guy we see is generically dictator.
Yeah, he's not specifically like, he's just generically like even the guy, the sunglasses thing that's to hide his mind wiped ways is just, generic dictator sunglasses.
Yes. Mm. He's straight out of like an 80s action film.
Mm-hmm.
He's sexy. Country of Val Verde.
She has made duplicates of herself, like, and you can tell the duplicates that they don't have enough tails.
Mm.
And she's influencing various world leaders to ensure nobody else interferes in this invasion of Japan.
So yeah, the Japan's allies aren't aiding them, or people they have peace treaties with aren't stepping up, or that kind of thing. Like, everyone's kind of leaving this to go down. Because like, I do like that, because like, in the modern world, like, one country can't just invade the other. It's like, that's a house of cards. This thing's going to hit off other things. But to prevent that, just to make these two nations war.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Wally Wall and Old Man Crybaby have disappeared because they answered a call while Kitaro was away, and they've not shown up. So Sandwich goes to investigate, and then she's disappeared as well because it's blowing Ray needs their powers to go after.
Yeah, Tomomai. I fuck this guy as soon as I saw him. But also, I was kind of like, I kind of want to see Wally Wall and Old Man Crybaby solve a fucking mystery about themselves. It's like, hey, Wally Wall, let's go solve the mystery.
Ooh,
and he gets them to surrender by threatening the tofu boy.
Poor tofu Kozo.
I'm both like that poor kid and also fucking kid. Stop getting in the fucking way.
Why are you always here? I'm a yokai carries tofu. What are you doing out in this bridge?
I'm going to absorb your tofu carrying power. Nothing can stop me then. God. All it needs is the power of being heavy, being a wall, and sand to defeat the nine-tailed fox.
I was questioning his logic of, well, you got two guys who turn into stone, but he was like, oh, Wally
Wall. Yeah, he seems like he's doubling up.
Kawaii can also move to like solid walls as well.
Yes.
He has power over all like freestanding wall-like structures that exist in a city.
Mm.
So Mao stops him from killing the tofu lad, and in return he reveals the truth about what Kitaro did.
Oh, the deal that he made with
yes.
Yeah. I did not need to see Sandwich get punched through the fucking chest as well. That was bad.
Okay, visit you, of course, you'll be back.
I know, but still, I was just like, Jesus, okay, that's pretty harsh.
It's like, I just imagine, like, Kitaro, probably. So, I feel I'm a part of the deal to get Nick and Musume back, but also into the bargain, also round up these other villains who are behind the plot, who were masterminds.
The extra masterminds, yeah.
How about you let me get my other friends who were killed back out as well? It's like, all right.
Because, is it Enma? Is called Kitaro in. He's like, hey, you're taking too long. I need the weight of their souls to keep hell pulled down so it doesn't leak into the regular world. Is that the idea behind it?
Yes, that is it. Because they then think Tamamona Mai's plan, the war, is a plan to overload hell with souls while it's doesn't have the right weight.
Yeah, that would obviously counterbalance it a bit.
So Ray then goes to confront her. Mana gets Kitaro to let her help for a change because she's got a divination scroll that the last one of the generals gave her to find the body of his loved one.
Mm.
And we come back to her bloodline of being a fortune teller. And so they track her down, but it is one of her doubles, not enough tails. Because where she is, she's in hell, draining the energy of the underworld. Because she's mind controlled all of the prison warders in hell.
Mm.
And the only one to see all this happen is the mirror guy, whose name I forget.
Kagami Gigi.
I saw it happen. Through the mirror.
It was backwards, but I got the gist of it.
Kitaro, but only Neko Masume is there. And Kitaro shows up and saves Ray, and then the episode weirdly ends as if this was half of a 1 hour special. It was a very weird ending.
It's very abrupt. It feels like this isn't even like a cliffhanger. It's like, wait, so now you're just gonna, okay, it's just over. All right.
We'll be back after a week long commercial break. Stay tuned.
I quite liked it. I liked the way Ray used all the powers that he'd got both in this episode and the previous ones.
Like, Kitaro's friends would be pretty badass if they fucking tried. even striking a cool pose before doing Old Man Crybaby's heavy rock thing.
Well,
yeah.
Well, that's the master technique. That's the kata for activating the power.
I guess it just looks dumb when he does it. dear.
And like the super quick escalation reminds me of the comic strips. I don't know whether this is based on a particular one or not, but
or is it just kind of going for that kind of pace? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I liked the Tamamono, my going into the history of that, where its origins in China were kind of coated up to the emperor and engineered the downfall of that dynasty or something like that before moving on, spreading it on again. It's just doing it again, but in the modern day, and now it has the capacity to spread much more widespread destruction, but on a possibly global scale, just based on, humanity's ability to create expansion things that will destroy ourselves.
I did like that eyeball kind of going, it's like, okay, she started this whole fucking war, and then a few hundred years later started this kind of war, and been in prison for 900 years, so this is a 2,000-year-old yokai you're dealing with. She doesn't fuck around. Watch out. And yeah, turns out she had a plan within a plan kind of thing. Mm.
It looks like next week Ray's powers start over, like overpowering his bone body.
Yeah,
I wonder about that. Or
yeah, it was something like if you take demons into yourself, they can, overtake you. And obviously, his arm's kind of cracking up, that he generally turns into a monster arm. So
yeah. I probably shouldn't have chosen this week to read all of Chainsaw Man on that front. I'm probably not going to live up to the Chainsaw Man's approach to that same story element.
It must have been the right week to watch it with this week's episode of Vinland Saga, though. Just the sheer amount of gore flying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so next week is Kyuubi no Kitsune. And then the following week is Nora Rihon's Ambition.
Oh, my God. It's what you could have guessed.
Yes, so is that what this all is all about, or is that an entirely new story?
It's hard to fucking know, yeah.
Because it would be a new series, and it may just be a new story. Anyway, let's carry on going. Another 13 weeks of Kitaro. At the very least. Sorry, Dragon Ball Super fans, you just have to carry on waiting.
You only got one incredibly awesome film this year. Just have to bide your time.
Yeah, you only got the film and this show, which stays consistently fucking good. Just doesn't have Saiyans in it. Most of the time.
It's got most of the actors from Dragon Ball in it, though, so you can still hear all your favorites.
That's true. It's still getting work. That's good.